Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Yes, we did. We bit that apple and the garden was lost. This is Harvey Wasserman with another Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Got a really strong show for you today. Paul Guipe, one of the great geniuses of the solar energy movement, of the green power conversion to Solartopia, wind power, all that great stuff, is going to be joining us from Bakersfield, California, in just a few minutes. But we're first, and we're going to get into the nitty-gritty. Paul has been with us previously on the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show. He is a total wealth of knowledge about the realities of the conversion to renewable energy, everything you want to know about solar, wind power, geothermal, ocean thermal, biofuels, increased conservation and efficiency, all that great stuff. We'll be with Paul Guipe around 20 minutes after the hour. We're going to start today with two really important people, Donna Gilmore from Southern California, one of the key leaders, strategizers, activists in the movement to very important world-saving movement to keep the San Onofre nuclear power plant reactors units 2 and 3 permanently, irrevocably and forever shut. And one of the truly great veterans of the anti-nuclear movement, a pioneer, a cornerstone of the decades and decades of fighting to keep nuclear power from wrecking our planet, Michael Marriott is with us from the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. Michael and Donna, are you on there?
Hey, Harvey, how are you?
How are you?
You're making me feel really old there.
Well, you're not as old as I am. Donna, are you with us?
Yes, I'm right here.
Okay, great. So we'll have about 20 minutes to talk, and then we'll be joined by Paul Guipe. You are both welcome to stay on when Paul joins us from California to talk another 40 minutes on the nitty-gritties of the conversion to Solartopia and renewable energy. Donna, let's start with you. You are in the belly of the beast right now in Los Angeles or thereabouts, confronting what I consider as important a reactor fight as there is in the country today, the struggle to prevent the San Onofre nuclear power plant from going back online. What could you tell us? What's the latest?
Well, the latest is, from all indications, it looks like the NRC is going to...
That would be the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
Nuclear Regulatory Commission, who has authority over allowing the plant to operate, is looking at approving in May... a potential restart, which would mean San Onofre could restart as early as May, possibly June of this year, and they have steam generators that fail, the replacement steam generators, due to a bad design, and one actually leaked radiation, and they're both showing decades of wear and less than 2 years of operation.
Uh-huh.
And they're not going to fix them, but they want to restart them without fixing them. And last time we were lucky. This time we might not be so lucky, and they could have these worn tubes and these steam generators. We could have a cascade failure, and we could actually be the next Fukushima down here. And for those that don't know...
Well, there's only 8 million people living within a 50-mile radius.
Within 50 miles.
What's your problem here?
But this is going to affect more than just 50 miles. Unlike Fukushima, where the wind blew into the ocean, here the winds are going to blow east, so the entire country will be affected if we have the meltdown at San Onofre. So it's very serious. And what a lot of people don't know is we actually have a 40% surplus of energy in California, and our electric grid operator has plans to carry us through another hot summer without San Onofre. So we're living with a nuclear plant that could potentially destroy the world economy, major food supplier for the nation, for energy we don't even need. That's the insanity of it.
It's pretty wacky. Michael Marriott, you're in the belly of the beast there in the Beltway, Tacoma Park, Maryland. not far from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Bethesda. What can you tell us about the latest on San Onofre?
Well, you know, this is typical Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The in this case, the utility wants to do something risky, and it, the NRC seems poised to approve it and to do whatever they can on behalf of the utility. It's what we've grown to expect from the NRC over the years. Now, you know, there is some chance that, you know, this may prove to be even too much for the NRC. We don't know yet for sure, but the, at least at the staff level, they seem to be buying into the idea that, well, since the steam generator, since we know it isn't going to work right at full power, let's run it at 70% power and see how it works. That's, you know, really putting the people of Southern California, making them, guinea pigs in a, you know, a science fair experiment.
Well, how can we stop this? What, there, you know, what is the possibility of making this go away, of not happening?
Well, you know, I think the main thing is what the people like Donna's been doing and other people in California is just to keep the pressure up on the California legislative delegation. I know Barbara Boxer, at least, has been responsive and concerned about this, and keep the pressure on the NRC and say, you know, hey, this, we don't experiment with major American cities. That's not a good idea.
Okay, so keep the pressure up. How? What is the what's the real nitty gritty key to doing this?
Well, like I said, phone calls to legislators, letters to legislators, and also to the NRC commissioners. I mean, they're eventually the ones that are going to make this decision. You know, I know there's legal action going on as well, but that's, you know, that's a little more limited as to what an average citizen can do. The average citizen, average person on the street, you have to let the people in power know that this is something that concerns you, because I'm sure it is.
Donna Gilmore, what is the nature of the campaign now in Southern California, and what are people really doing to win this?
Well, we're having citizens go to their, start out with their local city councils and state government. There's a total lack of awareness of this issue, and we find if we go through the local city councils, their voice carries a lot more weight than individual citizens. And
have you had city councils do this?
Oh, yes, we've had a lot of city councils in San Diego County and Orange County, and now Tuesday there's a meeting in Los Angeles, a city council meeting for a resolution there. So it's a growing movement. The question is, will it grow in time? Well, one of the things I'd really like to see is we could use some real talented entertainment folks, or people in the business, to find a way to get the message out, because one of our biggest roadblocks is there's a lack of public awareness about this. So if there's any people that have some talent there in the business that thinks that they could help, you know, I'd love to connect with them, give them the details, and you know, see if we could come up with a creative campaign that we can, you know, reach more of the public, because the regular press doesn't really publish much on this, and they use a lot of press release from the utility company, so it's a real disadvantage. The other thing is, Governor Brown actually has the authority to close that nuclear plant. He has the authority through the once-through cooling system that San Onofre uses, which is an illegal system according to the Federal Water Act. Our California Water Resources Control Board could shut them down based on that. Instead, they're giving them long extensions of time. And one of the basic reasons is, at least at the time they originally gave them the extension, is that they were important to the electric grid in California. But we know now, we've already been, you know, almost, what is it, a year and a half without San Onofre. We went through a really hot summer last year. and we didn't have brownouts or anything. So it's a big myth that we need the plant. So there's no justification to give San Onofre a pass for that reason.
Michael Marriott, what are the chances of getting the NRC, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, to not do this, to not license this? I understand there's a method of going to the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board. Is that possible?
Well, Friends of the Earth has been working on that end of things, and I'm not sure exactly where that's at. I don't mean to be too down, but this is the same Nuclear Regulatory Commission that recently decided not to install filter containment vents at the General Electric clone reactors of Fukushima in the U.S. Japan is going to be doing that, but the U.S. is not. The NRC decided not to. The majority of the current commissioners are convinced that all existing nuclear reactors are just fine and dandy.
And now, the former chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Greg Jasko, just said the opposite. This guy was the head of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for, 5 years before they purged him. And he made a public statement saying that none of the, correct me if I'm wrong, Michael, none of the operating 104 commercial reactors in the United States are safe. Is that possible?
That's exactly right. That's exactly what he said, and he said they should be phased out. He didn't rule out, some other type of nuclear power in the future, maybe smaller different design reactors, but he's now come to the conclusion, living through Fukushima and looking at the industry close up, that every reactor out there is fundamentally flawed and should be closed.
Well, we like that. Of course,
and the sooner the better.
In Japan, there were 54 reactors operating there now, two. And they seem to be doing all right. San Onofre is, to me, incredibly important. Well, I mean, I do have a vested interest. My grandson, all of 1 year old, lives in Los Angeles, along with my daughter and son-in-law. And I want this reactor, these two reactors, shut. If we do shut them, if we do get them permanently, if we prevent them from reopening, the number of reactors in the U.S. will drop to 100, and then soon thereafter we'll be out of triple figures. That's a big jump. So, Donna, I understand that tomorrow the Los Angeles City Council will be considering a resolution to keep San Onofre shut. Is that correct?
Yes. It's tomorrow at
10 a.m. in Los Angeles City Hall. Is that correct?
Right.
And this could have some weight, I guess. The Los Angeles City Council has recently passed, and we're going to be talking to Paul Greif in a minute about this, a feed-in tariff law. So there is a booming solar industry in Southern California. I just posted, actually, on the nukefree.org website, the fact that more people work in the solar industry now in California than work as actors. We like that. Michael Marriott, in D.C. there, what are the odds? What is the key to doing this? Is it important to get Barbara Boxer and Ed Markey more in play here? Because they did sign a letter warning that this is a dangerous situation.
Well, I think Senator Boxer, she's chair of the Environment Committee. She has a lot of oversight power over the NRC, and I think she, of all the senators, has been on top of the issue. I think what I have not heard as much from the California House delegation, and it would be good to start getting some of those people asking questions of the NRC and expressing concern. And although I agree with Donna, I think it's a very good way, very good organizing method, to go at the local level, to go to the city councils and the county councils and get these resolutions passed, and make sure that when these resolutions are passed, that they move on up the food chain, you know, move on up to the state reps and the state senators and up to the federal reps. And, you know, this is how, if you look at a lot of the major anti-nuclear battles over the years, the battle over Shoreham on Long Island, for example, what happened first was that, you know, the people of Long Island got angry about this reactor, and they went to their local officials, and their local officials went to, you know, the folks higher up until it, you know, became this overwhelming force to close the plant. And Governor Cuomo had no choice but to make sure the plant closed. And it's that kind of sustained organizing effort that, you know, pays off and can pay off in this case. I mean, you know, one of the units at Center Nofri, I think, is, you know, pretty much down for good. So we're only talking about the other one, and that's the one that we, you know, have to concentrate on right now. And
right,
you know,
and that's why
stop this nonsensical idea. You know what this is about is the utility doesn't want to spend the money to buy new steam generators. You know, they got rooked. They got bad steam generators. You know, these things cost a fortune. They cost a fortune to install. The plant shut down for a long time while it's installed, and they don't want to go through it again. This, you know, they are willing to cut any corner they can to avoid spending that extra money. Because, quite frankly, if you did a cost-benefit analysis, and I'm sure they've done this, it doesn't make sense to spend the extra money for the anticipated remainder of the lifetime of these reactors. So they're just trying to see what they can get away with.
And we need to stop them. Paul Guyper, are you on the line with us yet?
Harvey, I'm here.
All right, good, Paul. So listen, I want to wrap this up real quick. If we can get Senator Boxer to hold a hearing, an official hearing, prior to the NRC granting this license, do you think that will have an impact, Donna Gilmore?
I'm not. It definitely can't hurt. Anything that's going to bring more awareness and slow this thing down would help. I'd like to state efforts to heat up more.
Okay, well, let's work on that. Michael, you got.
Well, let me just point out one thing. You know, Senator Domenici, Pete Domenici of New Mexico, was a major nuclear advocate, and whenever he felt that the NRC was regulating too much, he'd bring them into his committee and remind them that he controlled their purse strings. I think this would be a good time for Senator Boxer to sort of take the opposite approach, bring the NRC in and remind them that she now controls their purse strings, and they better act accordingly.
Well, listen, folks listening in, if you're at all concerned, and I don't mean overly I do actually mean overly focused on Santa Onofre right now. There are other great fights going on at Vermont Yankee, Indian Point, Oyster Creek, so many other reactors where wonderful people, Pilgrim in Massachusetts, are working really hard to get them shut. But this is, Santa Onofre will be decided most likely within the next 2 months. And, if we can keep those two reactors down this summer, they will never reopen because that'll be two straight summers. And I think we'll have won this one. So, Michael Marriott, you are at www.nirs.org. Is that great? Is that correct?
Correct.
And you've done spectacular work over the years. Donna Gilmore, what's a good website for you?
SantaOnofreSafety.org.
SantaOnofreSafety.org. And, of course, we're continuing to post articles at nukefree.org. Thank you both so much. And let's make this happen, all right? So
okay.
The fate of the world, not to mention my grandson, depends on this.
Yeah, we all have a vested interest in making this happen.
Absolutely.
And
it's definitely doable. So for the duration, I'm going to continue to open every show with a little talk on Santa Onofre until we get this down. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Donna, so much.
Bye-bye.
All right, now we're on with the great Paul Guyp, Mr. Wind, Solar, Tidal, Geothermal, Ocean Thermal, the great conversion to solartopian energy, to wind power. Paul, you are actually downwind from Santa Onofre, so that first 20 minutes was for your benefit. Let's continue our great conversation that we had you on a couple weeks ago and spent a full hour talking about the conversion renewables, and you are just such an incredible wealth of information. discussion. So what would you like to start with today?
Well, Harvey, I would start with first language and second move right on into a recent meeting that I attended in San Francisco. First on language, I call this a energy revolution. I think others have called it an industrial revolution, a third industrial revolution. I call it an energy revolution. And what happened last week was a stirring event in San Francisco, truly inspirational for me. And I've worked with renewable energy for three decades now, and I haven't seen the enthusiasm for taking this to the next level since the early days of renewable energy in California, back in the heady days of the early 1980s. And this conference that was in San Francisco was pathways to 100% renewable energy. And when I say pathways to 100% renewable energy, I mean 100% in electricity, yes. We see a number of countries headed in that direction. Pathways to 100% renewable energy in the building energy supply, so for heating and cooling buildings, and 100% renewable energy in transportation. So these are very ambitious, but what's exciting and what was truly inspirational last week was the number of people and places, including here in North America, that are making that transition, that are revolutionizing the energy system in their communities, and they're heading in the direction that we all want to go. In that case, we don't need a nuclear plant.
Or coal or gas or any of the other filthy energy that they're throwing us, right?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the questions that came up listening to your setup here, listening to the nuclear activists, was about songs, certainly about songs.
Songs is spinning off the nuclear generating station.
That's right, the two reactors that we just talked about. Why do we need them? We made it through last summer. We will see. We should be able to make it through this summer. But why do we need to run them? They've proved that they're unsafe to operate. They proved that the engineers, unfortunately, were not competent to design the steam generators so that they would work in a replacement setting. And, you know, frankly, the reactors have been paid for. There's nobody out on the hook for them. We, the ratepayers of California, have already paid for these reactors. So why do we even need to run them?
Well, we don't, and that's the point. So what we need from you, Paul, in your, I won't disclose your age.
thanks, Harvey.
Is your incredibly deep expertise on exactly how to do this. How practical is it really to go to 100% renewable energy, and how quickly could it be done?
Well, what's surprising to me is it became done much quicker than even those of us who are advocates of renewable energy thought possible. When I started this 30 years ago, we thought, well, if we could get to 10% renewable energy and electricity supply, wow, that would be fantastic. And then we thought, well, maybe 15-20% would be attractive. We think we could do that. Wouldn't be too many problems. And now we think we've reached 15-20%. In Denmark, it's 43% now, 28%.
In Denmark, you have 43% of all energy used.
All electricity is from renewables, and 28% of all electricity is from wind energy alone. That's the variable resource. You know, the wind doesn't always blow. Sometimes it's real strong, sometimes it's not. 28% is from renewable resource, from variable resource like wind, and the remainder of that 43-44% is from biomass and biogas. They're already near 50%, and they're going to 100% by 2030. And Denmark is a country, Nordic country, strong Germanic background as well. And so, you know, when they say they're going to do something, you know, they're kind of people that actually can do it. And there are a number of other places that have very ambitious targets that say, you know, it's no longer pie in the sky. We think we can do this. And come back to your nuclear power situation. You know, when Germany said, well, we're going to close 8 reactors immediately after Fukushima, not wait till 2022 when they'll close the rest, but we're going to close 8 immediately. And, of course, there was an outcry that, oh, this is just terrible. It can't be done. and the lights will go off, and we'll just buy our nuclear electricity from France. Well, here we are, 2013. Germany is exporting more electricity than ever before, and most of that electricity can be exported because of the huge amount of electricity now being generated by wind and solar. I think last Friday, Germany generated almost 50% of its electricity consumption during a workday, so not on the weekend when the factories are closed, but during the workday, generated nearly 50% of electricity from wind and solar, and it wasn't even sunny yet. Wait till the summer. We'll see what happens this summer.
Right. And so, and of course, as we discussed on the last show that we did together, Fox News pointed out that the reason there's so much renewable energy in Germany is because they have so much more sun than
well, that's
the United States.
The Fox News version of reality, yeah.
Yeah, really. Now, you've also talked a bit about Amory Lovins and his latest work. Can you tell us a bit about that on his German growth on renewable energy and what Amory has said and where that piece is that you've referred to?
Well, that Amory, at his blog at the Rocky Mountain Institute.org, RMI.org, on his blog, Amory has posted an article saying it looks like Germany is demonstrating we actually can do this, that is, move to high penetration of renewables very quickly because they've accomplished what they've accomplished really within the last 10 to 15 years. They've been developing wind and solar for the past 20 years, but the bulk of the new generation come on has been in the last 10 or 15 years. And Amory just goes, you know, Amory, he just goes through the numbers. I think he titles it, Let's Do the Math, or Do the Math, implying if you do the math, you can see that Germany is really making a big difference in what our expectations of renewables can be or should be.
And how exactly is Germany doing this? What's the secret of what's going on in Germany that's not going on in the United States or other countries?
Well, the most important thing is that they have a law. It's called the Renewable Energy Sources Act in English, and that law has a provision.
You can't pronounce it in German, Paul.
It's Erneuerbare Energien Gesetz.
Oh, yeah. Okay, there you go. Go ahead.
And what that means, in English, the translation is the Renewable Energy Sources Act. And what that act says is that to prevent the country from growing dependence on foreign sources of fossil fuels, to prevent the country, and unfortunately the Germans have, as we all know, experienced this, to avoid potential international conflict for the acquisition of fossil fuels. And the Germans, more so than any other people, know the consequences of such things. And so for those reasons, and to prevent climate change, they have a policy that allows anybody with a renewable energy generator, whether it's a windmill or a solar panel or a biogas plant, to connect to the grid. They have a right, enshrined in law, to connect to the grid. They have a payment. They will be paid for their electricity. So the law says not only do you get to connect to the grid, utility must accept you on the grid, but they will pay you for the electricity, and the law actually says what they will pay you for the electricity over how many years. And with that, any investor, whether it's Barclays Bank or the local co-op or the homeowner, can finance the purchase of a windmill or a solar panel or a biogas plant and generate electricity and sell it to the grid for a profit.
So the key then is that if you are wanting to be a provider, if you want to be in the business of selling renewable energy, you can do it by getting into the grid, and they have to take you on the grid, and then they have to guarantee you a price for X number of years. Is that correct? Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly right. The shorthand for this in the United States is the awkward expression, feed-in tariff. You are allowed, or in Germany, you have the right to feed in electricity and be paid a fixed price for a period of 20 years. Different prices for different technologies. Wind is much less expensive than solar photovoltaics. That's the blue solar cells you put on your roof that make electricity. So they are paid less. than you would for the electricity than you would if you put the solar panels on your roof and biogas plants are someplace in between, and all the other technologies fall. They have a price also for geothermal. If you can build a geothermal power plant like we have here in California, you can get a fixed price contract with the utility for 20 years.
Wow. Okay, so now I just looked at your WindWorks site, WIND-WORKS.org.
Correct.
Right, and that's Paul Guype's, that's your basic, your core, your home website.
Yeah, that's my website where I talk about renewable energy and this policy called feed-in tariff. There's a whole section of my website that's devoted to feed laws, as in feed-in tariffs, as in feeding electricity into the grid. And we try and look at how feed-in tariffs are designed, where they work best, where they don't, what are the best practices, how to design them so they're both enable renewable energy development, but also enable everyone to participate so that we can democratize electricity generation. This is the other thing the Germans have done. Someone like Amory may not be quite so interested in that because his Do the Math article is all about the numbers, about the amount of electricity being produced. What you see when you go to Germany, you talk to a German farmer who has a windmill, said, how could you do this? He said, well, why wouldn't I do this? He votes conservative, so he'd be voting for a political party like our Republicans. Some might even be Tea Party-like members, very conservative farmers. And he said, I don't care about the environment. Sure, it makes my wife feel good that I put up a wind turbine, solar panels, but I make money, and that money can pay for my retirement, or it can pay for my kids' college, or I can buy a new pig barn with that money.
Well, then you make all that pig poop, and
then you make more electricity. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, so Paul, how would this play out in the United States? How could we do in the United States what Germany is doing, and you know, the Danes and so on? What's the key here?
Well, first thing is, of course, we have a federal system of government, just like the Germans. Of course, their system was constructed after the war, and we had a strong influence on how their political system would operate. We could pass a national law, do the exact same thing as the German law does. However, you and I both know that our Congress, our federal government, is broken, and that's very unlikely to happen. Washington is completely dysfunctional, and I think most Americans, unfortunately, realize that. There is something Mr. Obama could do, President Obama could do, if he had the initiative, if he had the will, he could issue an executive order to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and say, you could implement, FERC, we want you to implement a system of feed-in tariffs through the state regulatory authorities, state public utility commissions, and we will set up a national trust fund. This national trust fund will be exactly like the Federal Highway Trust Fund, which we use to build highways all across the United States and through each state. And we will place a fee, whatever you want to call it, on every purchaser of electricity in the United States, General Motors to Harvey Wasserman to Paul Guype. Everybody will pay a small fee or tax for this renewable energy revolution in the United States. And that will go into the Renewable Energy Trust Fund administered by FERC, or we could set up he could order some other agency to be set up. And then the federal government, through the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, could say to state governments, if the state government sets up the program to comply with this law, just like we do with the highway department, then that money will be reimbursed to you. Now, some states may choose not to do this. And in our system of government, they can choose not to do it. But then they don't get the money. They don't get paid for money that's already been collected from their citizens if they don't participate in a program. It's exactly how the Highway Trust Fund works. Chris Nelder, an authority on energy policy, has been talking about this, suggesting people write President Obama and say, create a renewable energy trust fund and set it up today and let's get moving.
Well, how rapidly could we make this change in the United States? You know, Germany is going to be Well, you tell me, how soon will Germany be 100% renewables, and how soon could the United States be?
Well, first, let's take Germany. Germany has targets. They will reach 35% of electricity by 2020. It looks like they can do that. And 80% of their electricity supply with renewables by 2050. 80%, as far as I'm concerned, is getting pretty close to 100. So I'm okay with that. The United States, of course, is a much different market. It's much, much bigger. But we could go much faster than we're going today. And I think that we could do it. If we wanted to, we certainly could do something by 2030. We could have a substantial portion of electricity supply from new renewables. Now, let me say what I'm talking about here, Harvey. Since 1983, the peak in renewable electricity generation in the United States, the peak percentage of our supply that came from renewables was reached in 1983.
Really?
So that's 30 years ago. We haven't got back to that level since then. In 30 years, our development of renewable energy hasn't even kept pace with the growth of electricity consumption in the United States. The highest percentage, or we say in the business, the penetration of renewables in the system in the United States occurred in 1983, and we haven't even got to that level yet. That was like 15%, and we're at 12.5% today. We're going in the wrong direction, Harvey. That's the problem. We have to stop doing what we're doing, make this transition, make this revolutionary change, and in the process, revive the American economy by giving the American people an opportunity to invest in renewable energy for their own benefit and the benefit of their children and grandchildren, like your grandson there in Los Angeles.
Well, but the gross volume of the amount of energy produced by renewables in the United States has grown. It's just shrunk as a percentage of the whole pie. Is that correct?
That's correct. The amount of hydroelectricity we produce in the United States has only slightly increased. The amount of geothermal energy that we've produced in the United States has increased quite a bit in the 30 years. And, of course, the amount of wind energy we've developed in the United States has increased quite dramatically. But in the process, unlike other places where their consumption of electricity per capita has decreased, here in the United States, we've got two things working against us. One, we have an out-of-control population growth in the United States. And the second thing is our consumption per capita continues to increase, except here in California. And so what's happened is the United States now consumes 4,000 billion kilowatt-hours of electricity per year, and that's far more than we consumed back in 1983. So the percentage of renewable energy, that's both old renewable energy, hydro, and new renewable, like wind and solar, still hasn't made as high a penetration into the electricity supply as we did back in 1983.
Wow, that's pretty amazing.
And now, Harvey, let me go on to say,
please,
that in contrast, you take a place like Portugal. Now, in the first quarter of this year, so the first 3 months of this year, Portugal generated 70% of its electricity with old and new renewables.
And wait, say that again? 70% of what?
70% of Portugal's electricity generation in the first quarter of this year was 70% of the total electricity supply. That's from both old hydro, because they have lots of hydro power plants in Portugal, and from all the wind turbines and solar panels. Mostly it's from the windmills.
Huh.
And last year it was probably around 50%, and the difference is that they had a good wet year, they had a rainy year, and so the hydro is far more variable than most people think. They think of windmills and solar panels as being highly variable. Well, they're variable on a daily and maybe an hourly basis, but hydro is very variable from 1 year to the next. Interannual variability is much greater for hydro than it is for wind and solar. And so in a place like Portugal, which is mountainous and Mediterranean climate like here in Southern California, they have good wet years, and they have dry years, and they've had a couple of really dry years, and the hydro production has been way down. But now they've had a good hydro year, the wind is blowing, and in the first quarter, 70% of their supply came from mostly wind and hydro.
Well, that's fantastic. Now, how does the price compare? What are we talking about in terms of what this stuff costs?
And where, Harvey? Be a little more specific for me.
Well, let's say that the, you know, as the industry will do, they like to say that renewables are more expensive than fossil fuels and nuclear power. So if this...
Okay.
So
all right,
how do we compare what the pricing is?
Well, typically what people who are opposed to renewables like to do is say renewables are more expensive than coal, for example. Well, usually they're only talking about solar, and they're only talking about coal-fired power plants that were built 20 and 30 years ago. Essentially, they've been paid for. So, yes, you're just paying for the coal, not for the power plant. But if you look at the average cost of renewables, so that would be the cost of the solar systems and the cost of wind and the cost of biogas, usually the average is less than the cost of a new coal-fired power plant. And of course, I don't need to tell you this, it's far less than the cost of a new nuclear plant.
Well, the cost of a new nuclear plant is infinite since we're not going to let them build anymore.
Okay,
so it's
well,
either infinite or it's zero.
I'm sympathetic to your point of view, Harvey, yeah. But the Brits seem to be hell-bent on trying to build two more reactors at least, and Electricité de France, who will be the people that will be building this plant, and of course the French taxpayer will be on the hook if anything goes wrong, the cost they're talking about now are being 15 and 20 U.S. cents per kilowatt hour. That's what's been published. That's not what it may really cost, but that's what's been published.
Well, I got. I don't think the Brits are going to get anywhere near building a new reactor. I think that the ones in Georgia and South Carolina are going to be canceled. You know, I love following these guys. They delivered a reactor pressure vessel to the port of Savannah to take it into Vogtle, the nuclear plant there, and the thing fell off the railroad tracks. I mean, God, these are the great geniuses that are supposed to run our nuclear plants, for God's sakes. You know, the prospect of new renewables is staggering. And I want to point out at nukefree.org, nukefree.org, which is I edit for Bonnie Raitt, Jackson Brown, and Graham Nash. I've posted Paul Guype's latest here, A Guide to Feed-In Tariffs. Well, it's probably not your latest, but it's a mainstay of your site, Windworks, wind-works.org. And below that is a wonderful article from Power Engineering magazine, and not exactly a left-wing radical publication here. And I love the headline. That's not the headline they have, but U.S. solar industry has more people working in California than are actors in Hollywood. I love that. And according now to the industry, there are 119,000 people in the United States, 119,000 Americans working in the solar industry. Does that sound about right?
Probably. I mean, the United States is pretty hard to track because I don't actually trust a lot of the statistics that come out of the U.S., unfortunately.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, just because we have a Politburo in the Soviet Union here, and just because the Koch brothers are about to take over the Los Angeles Times, that is a staggering, oh my God.
Let's try not to go there, Harvey, because we can get depressed very quickly. Let's just tend to focus on what has been accomplished and what your listeners need to hear, and that is this renewable energy revolution, one, is possible. Two, is happening now in other countries. Three, Americans are fully capable of doing this. I would say North Americans. I'd like to include Canadians in this because the province of Ontario shows that they can do it when they want to. And I think Americans are fully capable. We, you know, once Americans, Harvey, were known as people who had a can-do attitude, and that's what we need again here in the United States, is give Americans, give Canadian citizens, an opportunity to develop renewable energy for their own profit, but also for the profit of their communities and for the benefit of their children and grandchildren. And I think if you gave Americans and Canadians an opportunity to do that, stand back. I think we'd all be pleasantly surprised what would happen in both countries.
Well, let me read you a piece. It's called, this is a piece I posted at nukefree.org. Where solar jobs are, new map reveals nationwide growth. And then we're quoting here Andrea Luck, in comparing our estimates with data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, we find that California now has more solar workers than actors, and that there are more solar jobs in Texas than there are ranchers. I like that. Economies of scale are also making our industry more labor efficient, requiring only one-third the number of workers to install a megawatt of solar today as it did in 2010. That's only 3 years ago, for God's sakes. And according to the report, the top 10 states for solar jobs in 2012 were California, Arizona, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Colorado, New York, Texas, Michigan, and, amazingly enough, Ohio. So this
now
is a booming...
That's solar for Ohio, yes.
Oh, for solar it would be the PV...
The manufacturer, yeah.
The photovoltaic manufacturer up near Toledo.
Right.
And they are still in business, I guess?
Like all solar companies, they have gone through a tough spell, but as far as I know, they're still there.
Yeah. Now, the tough spell is due essentially to a massive dumping of photovoltaic cells by the Chinese. Is that correct?
That's correct. And First Solar is no different than a lot of other companies. They've outsourced a lot of their production to Asia, but they still do have the plant in Ohio. They may have a plant in Arizona, too. I don't remember.
Uh-huh. So the Chinese have been dumping solar panels, unlike the Japanese have been dumping gargantuan quantities of radioactive lethal material into the ocean and the water. So what you're here to tell us, Paul, is that this green revolution is happening. What is the bigger of the industries? I've been saying for some time now that I think that photovoltaic cells, PV, the solar industry, will be the biggest industry in the history of the world, because everything on this planet is going to be covered with some form of PV. Window glass, buildings, of course, parking garages, automobiles. I'm waiting to start seeing new automobiles coming out with the photovoltaic cells embedded in their roofs and hoods and trucks.
I think that you're right that this is going to be a huge industry. It is a huge industry now. It's just that we as Americans don't always know that or see that. It's a huge industry in China. It's a huge industry in Germany, but it's not just solar. Solar PV is just one technology. We have a multi-billion-dollar wind industry. There's now a quarter 250,000 megawatts of wind turbines operating worldwide. It'll be over 300,000 megawatts by the end of the year.
How does that compare to nuclear? You're talking about a quarter million megawatts? Of solar, is that right?
No, of wind, Harvey.
Of wind.
The thing about the difference between wind and solar, when people like me throw around these numbers, and a lot of journalists don't get this straight, that's why I'm bringing it up. Wind is far more productive per megawatt of generating capacity installed because it's different than solar, and so you have to keep that in mind. Typically, we produce about twice as much electricity per megawatt of generating capacity as solar. That's just the fundamental physics of this. And so when we look at renewables, one of the problems I've seen in America, and particularly by advocates and by anti-nuclear advocates, Harvey, is that they see only... For some reason, Americans, I don't know why we do this, we're always ready to grasp at panaceas. And solar is seen by a lot of people as a panacea. It's just one technology. And when we develop a renewable system that has high penetration of renewables in an electricity system, we'll just take electricity, so let's say 100%. 60% of that electricity has to be generated by wind, and maybe 40% generated by PV. Now, you won't find many PV advocates in the United States saying that, but that's the reality. You have to have a lot of wind, because the wind is far more productive, and the wind doesn't always stop when the sun goes down. So if you're going to have an integrated system that has a very high penetration of renewables, 100%, which means you want them to, you want some of this stuff to be working all the time to minimize the amount of fossil fuels that you have to burn, keeping the amount of fossil fuels you burn down to just a few hours a year, about 60% of that electricity, about two-thirds of that electricity has to produce with wind.
Wow. Okay, so you got solar and you got wind, and they're at the top of the food chain here.
That's right. And then you'd have biogas, because biogas can be stored.
Where does biogas? I just had yesterday was 420, the marijuana day, or Saturday was. And I got I had the wonderful opportunity. There's nothing, I've given up, you know, hundreds of speeches. There's nothing more fun than speaking to a bunch of stoners. I mean, you know, they're out there, they're going like, oh man, what'd he say? And, you know, stuff like that. So I spoke to a group of, you know, marijuana advocates about hemp Saturday. And hemp, of course, is about, I believe it's about to be legalized finally in, of all places, Kentucky.
It makes sense for Kentucky. Kentucky and Indiana used to grow hemp during the war, Second World War. We grew hemp for fiber for making a rope.
Right. And now, of course, you know, hemp is widely touted as an energy crop, along with, you know, Jerusalem artichokes and other stuff.
But I don't think Harvey, I agree that it's hemp makes a great energy crop, but we don't need to go to energy crops. This is part of what my work is, about, and, you know, this is part of what Amory is talking about. We don't need to go to energy crops as such as where we take land out of food production. We're going to need all the land for food production we can because we're going to have 9 billion people on the earth. But we have enough waste, particularly in a country like the United States, that we produce so much waste relative to other people, that we have so much waste that right now we're not using at all. And those can be energy crops. And that can be our energy crop. And it continues to increase. And what's important about that, Harvey, is that we can store biogas from a waste digester just like we store natural gas today. So when those wind turbines aren't producing as much electricity as we need, or the sun has gone down and the solar panels have turned off for the day, we can use that biogas that was produced, I don't know, several days, weeks, months before, that's been stored in underground caverns or even stored just in the pipelines themselves, and then we don't even need natural gas.
Well, that's something to look forward to.
And we don't need a frack for natural gas.
We're talking with Paul Geip, one of the truly great, exciting, brilliant, and earth-shaking geniuses behind the true transition to Solartopia, which is happening as we speak, accelerating every day. How fast is this accelerating, Paul, the whole conversion to renewables? I mean, what is the real growth rate in renewable capabilities that you see in the U.S. and worldwide?
Well, I'm not going to talk about the U.S. because the U.S. is really a market that we can't, you can't make estimates about because our policies are inconsistent. The Koch brothers are very influential. The coal industry and the fossil fuel industry, even the nuclear industry, still remains influential in the United States. But worldwide, wind is growing about 20% to 40% growth rate. I don't know, most people don't have an innate sense of what that means, but that's like doubling every few years in the total.
Well, every
amount
two
of
or
capacity.
Three, yeah.
Yeah. And solar has been growing truly exponentially. The charts the curve practically goes off the chart. And I don't know how much to anticipate solar will grow because it, you know, depends on what China does now. The Germans, the first couple of months of the year, the Germans have been trying to tamp down the growth of solar because, frankly, they're getting more solar than they're getting wind. And as I said, if you want the proper balance, you've got to have more wind than solar. And they've been trying to tamp down the growth in solar, but in the last month of the quarter, growth took off again. So we don't
darn
know what
growth.
The Germans
well,
will do.
That pesky growth, it just keeps coming back.
Well, this is what happens with the solar PV market. You know, the Germans, the news media likes to come out with these horror stories and say the Germans have cut the price for solar PV again. And I say, good. And they say, what, you're not upset? No, they need to cut the price. They need to tamp down the growth, and we don't want to pay more for renewable energy, more for solar or wind, than we have to. We don't want to waste money. We want to get good value, and the Germans have been doing that. So, you know, the Germans are paying about paying 50% less for solar than we are in the United States, the mighty great United States.
And yet, here we pioneered the technology.
Well, yeah, and like many things, like videotapes and so on, we gave it up. And we even gave this policy that's driven Germany and Denmark and Spain and Portugal, and I'll just go down to Greece. We talked about Greece on the last show. The policy that drove this success is a policy that was developed by us, by Americans here in California in the early 1980s, and that's why we had the growth of renewable energy here in California. But then we decided we just didn't want this here renewable stuff, and we canceled that policy. We did away with it. We don't even talk about it in some places. In some places, it's a forbidden discussion among the staff at, for example, our California Public Utility Commission. They're almost embarrassed to admit that it was an American idea. Now, that's shocking.
Yeah, really, it's a shame. Paul, in addition to solar, wind, and biofuels, which we've touched on, what do you, geothermal you mentioned? What do you see about some of the other ones like wave energy and tidal energy? Are they going to be just bit players, or is there a big future for them?
Well, bit players can still be $1 billion industries. Nova Scotia, province of Canada and the Eastern Seaboard, they want to be big in tidal power because they have the Bay of Fundy, and they have a feed-in tariff for tidal power. They have a feed-in tariff for community-owned renewables, so farmer-owned, village-owned, co-op-owned wind, but they also have a feed-in tariff for tidal power plants. So, yes, I see that's going to be some growth, but right now that technology is not here, not today. And I only care about what we can build now and build today. And if they have a feed-in tariff that allows that industry to grow so that it's profitable and that it's reliable, so be it. But in the meantime, we know wind works, we know solar works, we know biogas works, we know geothermal works. Let's get busy building this stuff.
Well, what do you tell the right-wingers who say that the feed-in tariff is a subsidy?
It's a market mechanism that pays for production. It's exactly the way we regulated electric utilities in the United States and Canada and for much of the world for the past 100 years. It worked pretty good, kept the lights on, and got us a lot of electricity. Unfortunately, it led to the construction of a large nuclear power plants that were overrun their cost estimates, became albatrosses around the necks of both ratepayers and the utilities that built them. And as a consequence, it led us down this dark path of neoliberalism that caused us to abandon a very workable system. So feed-in tariffs are not a subsidy. They're payment for electricity generated, and it's a market mechanism that we need to introduce here in the United States.
All right, Paul Guy, wind-works.org. We're just going to have you back again and again, Paul. You're just so great on the radio, and you know so much. We really appreciate your great work. We'll be talking to you again. This has been another hour of the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show with Harvey W., your man on the scene here. Every week we will be talking about shutting San Onofre and other nuclear plants. Next week, Jill Stein of the Green Party will be with us. Paul, thanks again so much. We'll be talking.
Bye.
No nukes, everybody.
Well, we bit that apple, and the garden was long.